Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast and I'm Michelle Grattan. The issue of asylum seekers and refugees has been very much in the news again, especially with the plight of a Somali woman on Nauru who says she was raped and was brought to Australia for an abortion which then did not go ahead. This led to conflicting claims, the government saying she'd changed her mind and the woman saying she didn't get the counselling she needed before making a final decision. She's now back in Nauru with her medical future in limbo. Today we talk with Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young about this and other issues. Senator, the Somali woman now says she still wants the termination, but says it should be done not in Australia but in a third country. How do you think this issue should now be handled?
Well, look, firstly, Michelle, this has just been a horrific circumstance for this young woman. Over and over again, it's been bungled from the beginning. It took the department 6 weeks to even act on her first request when she said that she was pregnant as a result of a rape. And then, of course, as we know, took the department 6 weeks to get her here, and she was only here for a handful of days and went home without, as she puts it, getting the care that she'd asked for, and I believe the care that she needs. She still hasn't seen anybody for proper counselling over the sexual assault, let alone the issues in relation to a pregnancy termination. So it is so awful, this circumstance for this young woman, Abiyan. I think it's time to have an independent advocate appointed for her, because I can't see how it's going to be dealt with properly or with any confidence, either by the public or by the government, unless we have somebody who is with her, is able to be very clear with her about what the options are and what she needs when communicating back to the government. And I must say, I think the government's attitude to her legal team so far has been pretty poor, and an independent advocate would, in a way, be a circuit breaker.
But do you see any way of getting this done? Because, after all, time is an issue now.
Well, it is definitely an issue, and she's 15 weeks pregnant. It could happen this week if the government was willing to, and I've urged the Prime Minister today to appoint an independent advocate and get it out of the hands of Peter Dutton so that this woman can actually get the care she needs quickly.
Have you had any response from the Prime Minister or his office?
I haven't as yet, but I would imagine that the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, he wouldn't be feeling too good about how this has all unfolded in the last week. Peter Dutton clearly has bungled it, clearly hasn't managed this from a very compassionate perspective at all. And you can see the reaction from the Australian community. People are outraged that this young woman has been treated so poorly.
Now, just turning to the asylum seeker issue more generally, the Greens want all offshore asylum seekers that are in Manus and Nauru brought to Australia, but the government is not going to do this. And given that fact, what is the possible practical fallback that you think the government should be pursuing with these people? Are you critical, for example, of the government trying to do a deal with the Philippines to take some?
Look, in reality, there has to be some medium-term solution that's come up with, because the individuals on Manus Island cannot stay there in the medium and long term, and the families on Nauru, that is just simply unworkable. They can't stay there. The Nauru government clearly doesn't want them there in the long term. The community in Nauru has not been very welcoming to people, and of course all of the horrific details of abuse and assault and attitude towards people, particularly young women. And there is a number of single young women on Nauru, particularly from places like Somalia and Sudan. And these are women who fled camps in Africa, many of them because they were being they were in the camps and they were being sold off as brides to warlords. They got themselves out of these camps. They're pretty strong women, and they found themselves in Nauru, and there is no long-term future there. We have to come up with another way of dealing with them. And I stand by the fact that the most practical and common sense approach would be for the government to find a way to bring them here. And I understand that they're saying no, but what other options do they have? Sending them off to the Philippines or Cambodia. The Cambodian deal hasn't worked. We've gone from 4 people being sent there to now 3 because a Rohingya man has realised that there's no future for him in Cambodia. He doesn't have family reunion. He's not going to be able to get a job. That's not refugee resettlement.
What about the Philippines, though? That seems a
look. The Philippines
place.
is an interesting idea from the government. It seems that it's still very much in its formation. The only reason we know is because clearly someone involved in the negotiations here isn't happy about it because it's been leaked. It still seems pretty poor. I mean, even this week we've seen the Philippines having to put their hand up for international help, particularly with emergency aid because of the typhoon. And they've got their own problems. Why would we be wanting to send refugees that Australia could resettle here to the Philippines just so the government can save face? The government here could save face by encouraging the individuals on Nauru to think about what types of things they'd like to do in Australia. And we've got engineers, we've got teachers, we've got doctors, we've got nurses, we've got a journalist and his family who are stranded on Nauru. And why not find ways that they could be brought to the Australian community and start contributing?
The Greens advocate a whole different approach to asylum seekers, processing them in regional countries. But how would that work in practice? It seems an amorphous idea.
Mm. Look, I think one of the biggest problems we've got with this whole debate is that it is seen to be between two options. Option A, which would be don't do anything, let the boats come. It's very crude because it almost suggests that whoever gets here can stay, but if you happen to die at sea on the way, well, so be it. I mean, it's pretty abhorrent, and I don't know anyone who's advocating that position. It is not an option. And then there's option B, which is what we've got, which is, again, just more cruelty. So we actually have to come up with another way. If we don't like what we're seeing with how people are being treated, there has to be another option, an option C. And the way I would describe how we would do it is that Australia funds the reception of people in Malaysia and Indonesia, that we give support to Malaysia and Indonesia financially to ensure people can get access to schools, to doctors, and they have access to work, a work visa, and the people found to be refugees, we bring to Australia. But with us processing with alongside the UNHCR, people who aren't refugees get sent home. You don't have the sugar, as the government would say, on the table if you're sending people who aren't legitimate refugees home before they even get on a boat.
You'd have to have a fair amount of Australian control and a fair amount of Australian dollars for all that to work, wouldn't you? And presumably a limit on the people who could be taken.
Well, look, we've done it before. We did it in the Fraser years when there was a need in our region, and there is a need in our region now. And the advantage that we have is we don't have the numbers of people pouring across our border the way Europe does right now. What I'm describing is what Europe is currently debating. But I'm saying let's do it while we have the space to do it, while we have the opportunity to put in place a system rather than having to scramble at the last minute. Yes, it would cost money. Yes, Australia would have to be very much involved. But there is an opportunity to show goodwill in the region. And it means redirecting some of the money we're spending currently on detention, which is billions of dollars on a regional system, which would be far, far cheaper.
Let's change topics. The government has now totally reworked the family tax benefit savings package that it put up in 2014 and that could not be got through the Senate. What's the Greens' view of this new package?
Well, firstly, let me just say, I mean, it's a little bit embarrassing for poor Joe Hockey on the day that he leaves that there is finally some kind of breakthrough with at least the Labor Party on one of the key issues that was a sticking point for him. But it's really not dealing with the issue at large. This is the coalition government still trying to make savings from some of the most vulnerable families in Australia. And taking money off single parents and sole income families just because your kid has turned 13 doesn't make much sense to me. I mean, is this about having a fair go and supporting the families most in need? Or is this about saying, oh, well, we think you're less likely to jump up and down and make a noise, so we'll take money off you because it's an easy bet?
So do you think it will get through the Senate?
Well, it seems as though Labor is trying to take credit for the change at the moment.
So they're still arguing the point on some issues, though.
Yeah, and look, we'll see how firm they're prepared to go. We're not happy with it the way it is because we think it is still being unfair to single parents and sole income families. But we'll look at the legislation in more detail.
Were the Greens involved in the talks?
No, not directly. I mean, I know the minister has been meeting with our spokesperson about it, but in terms of our position, that's still going to be a process of discussion.
One deal that is absolutely done now is the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement. Labor put up some changes and there's been a deal on those. Are you still critical of that agreement?
Yes, we are. And we think that the window dressing effectively of the changes that the Labor Party have agreed on amounts really to nothing more than rolling over on this. I mean, the real problems in relation to labour market testing are in the core document and they still remain there. Whatever changes Labor's made haven't changed the point about that core underpinning of the labour market testing. And of course there's the whole other issue about the secrecy of all of this. I mean, right from the word go, we didn't get all the details and we were told as a parliament, as a country, take it or leave it. And if you want people to believe in what you're doing and support what you're doing, governments have got to learn to be a bit more upfront and transparent. And this government, just like it was under Tony Abbott, it feels as though it's continuing under Malcolm Turnbull. You know, don't tell people what you think they might not need to know. No, that's not how the parliament works. If you want people to believe you, if you want people to back you, be upfront about what you're doing.
There's also surely, though, a question of cost-benefit here. There are many benefits in this deal to Australia, and the cost, you say, is labour market problems that maybe it could take jobs from Australians, undercut conditions, whatever. Is that your argument?
But I think there's some other problems with it, though, too.
Is the threat serious enough to outweigh the benefit is
Look,
what I'm saying.
I think one of the other things that is really problematic with it, and of course I'm saying all this without having all of the detail, and this is the problem, that we don't have all the detail. So what is the, you know, cost-benefit analysis when, how do you do that if they haven't given you everything, been upfront about all the information and what really the deals consist of? One of the areas that strikes me as absurd and very, very problematic is that the opportunity for Chinese companies to sue the Australian government and therefore the Australian taxpayer if we decide to change laws here or directions or emphasis. The idea that companies can sue our government for making decisions that the people want, why on earth we'd sign up to that is beyond me. And I know it's been softened in a way, but it's still able to happen. And I'm very worried about what that means for particularly Chinese mining companies. And what happens if a mining company thinks that we've got a set of rules now, and then in a few years down the track, the Australian people say, you know what, we are really worried about the environmental degradation here. The Chinese company can turn around and sue the taxpayer. It's not okay.
In an entirely different area, the Japanese are becoming provocative again on the question of whaling. This just seems an ongoing saga and we can never get anything really done about it. Is there anything more that can be achieved in this area to stop this?
It's astonishing how quiet Greg Hunt has been on this since becoming the Environment Minister. In opposition, he was very loud about this and he's been... almost as if he's under the sea in relation to tackling this at all. And this is extraordinary. We now have a situation where the Japanese government is saying, we don't like what the umpire's decision was in the international court, so we'll pull out and we'll set up a different game with no umpire, so we can carry on in taking their bat and ball and going home. And it really is quite an affront to the international system, but also to Australia. I mean, we went through the international court because it was the right thing to do. Everybody could put their case. The Japanese lost the position clearly and they're just now flouting it. It is... You've got to wonder, when will this government start standing up and speaking out on it again? Because the Japanese government clearly are taking advantage of the fact that here in Australia, Greg Hunt and the coalition are pretty much mute. That's got to change.
Just talking about politics more generally, how much do you think the vibe has changed with the arrival of Malcolm Turnbull?
I think it's changed a lot, actually, and that, being very honest, even the atmosphere in the building seems to have changed. The harsh rhetoric has been dialed down a little bit. People seem to be walking around this place with a few more smiles.
Is Peter Dutton nicer to you?
Peter Dutton's no nicer to me, but I guess that's a really interesting point, actually, because he's the last festering sore of the Abbott government who's left on Malcolm Turnbull's front bench. And it's going to be a problem for him. And if we go back to what we were saying about this young woman on Nauru, I can't imagine Malcolm Turnbull feels comfortable with that. And he's going to have to decide, is it worth having Peter Dutton as his whipping boy, or should he remove him? Frankly, I think he's got to go. And if he did do that, if Malcolm Turnbull did stand Peter Dutton down, I think the government would start to look up.
What do you think are the implications for the Greens of the change of leadership? One can imagine, for example, that quite a few people who used to be referred to as doctors' wives in the Howard era, people who didn't like, for instance, the harshness of Tony Abbott, might have parked their vote with the Greens for the time being. But those people surely would be more inclined now to go back to Turnbull, so that could take a few votes from you.
Mm. Look, I think it's a really interesting question, and something that I've been talking to the public about, and constituents as I've been travelling around the country. There is very much a sense of high expectation on Malcolm Turnbull, and in a way, as he's in a honeymoon period at the time, and we'll have to see. He's going to have to act. He's going to have to follow through on these things. Voters who want to see a more progressive, more optimistic, visionary type government are going to need that support for that government in the Senate in particular. So I think in terms of where the Greens are headed and into the next election, if people want Malcolm Turnbull to be able to be as a progressive Prime Minister, then they're going to need a progressive watch on him in the Senate. And I think in a lot of ways that strengthens the Greens' hand.
Presumably, though, we've got the Labor Party and the Turnbull Liberal Party competing very much in the centre. And does that mean that there's going to be more distance on the left between the Greens and Labor?
I don't think so. I think, if anything, what we're seeing is people looking at both the Coalition and Labor Party on a policy front, and they're pretty much the same. They're looking at Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten, and clearly, I mean, I don't have to tell you, the polls show that Malcolm Turnbull is far more popular with pretty much everyone than is Bill Shorten. People who want the Greens to be a strong voice for keeping those whoever is in government on track, for ensuring that the issues of a progressive Australia are promoted and enacted wherever possible, that's not going to be left to Bill Shorten. The Greens are going to have to be there.
Sarah Hanson-Young, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and I'll be back with you with another interview quite soon. This is Michelle Grattan.